Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Bob McGrath. I'm a director of the organization Senior Statesmen of Virginia. We're very pleased today to have two people who are share a major responsibility for implementing the state of Virginia's new Virginia Clean Economy Act. They'll tell us what its goals are and about how it will be implemented. The two speakers we have today are both from the Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy in Richmond. We have Al Christopher with us, who is the director of the department, of the Energy Division of the department. He's been there about 4 years. Prior to that, he was executive director of Virginia Clean Cities, a nonprofit coalition that promotes alternative fuel and electric vehicles. He has a bachelor's degree in mass communications and an MBA, both from Virginia Commonwealth University. Our other speaker is Michael Skivington. He is the director of policy and planning for the Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy. He also leads the agency's strategic planning team. He's a lifelong Virginian. He's received a bachelor's degree in a business administration from Old Dominion University and a law degree from George Mason University. So I will be the moderator. By the way, before we get going, I want to tell you, for those of you who are not totally familiar with Senior Statesmen of Virginia, we're organized, founded about 25 years ago, and each month we try to bring very interesting and important programs about public policy or politics of interest at the regional level or the Commonwealth level or the federal level. So if you want to find out more about the organization, please look at our website. You can see a list of all the interesting programs we've had over the years. And if you're not yet a member, we sure encourage you to become a member. It's quite easy, and you can see how to do that on the website. Okay, having said that, Michael, which one of you will lead off?
I will go first, and Al will take us home.
Great.
Okay, can you see my screen?
I can.
Okay, great. Well, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Michael Skiffington, Director of Policy and Planning with the MME. And before we get started, Al and I would like to send a special shout out and thank you to any veterans we might have tuning in today. Thank you very much for your service. Here is what we're going to be talking about. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the agency and set the scene of what electricity regulation was like in the Commonwealth before the Clean Economy Act. I will hit very few of the highlights, and then I'll turn it over to Al, who will dig into the topics within the bill that you see there on your screen, and then we'll have some time for Q&A at the end. So the Department of Mines, Minerals, and Energy, our mission is to enhance the development and conservation of energy and mineral resources in a safe and environmentally sound manner in order to support a more productive economy in Virginia. We're an executive branch agency in the Secretary of Commerce and Trade, and we have about 175 full-time employees spread across four offices in the Commonwealth: Richmond, where Al and I are based, Charlottesville, and then our two largest offices are in far southwest Virginia, in Lebanon and Big Stone Gap. You can divide our functions into two buckets, a non-regulatory bucket and a regulatory bucket. On the non-regulatory side, we have Al's shop, the Division of Energy, which is the statewide energy office. We execute the Virginia Energy Plan and various renewable energy programs that support the plan. And we also provide staff support to various boards and authorities. We also house the State Geologic Survey in our Charlottesville office. They do a lot of geologic mapping to identify where minerals are located and then helping localities develop those resources. And we also investigate geologic hazards, such as landslides. New division was created in the General Assembly session this year to create a new division of offshore wind, whose main goal is to facilitate Hampton Roads as the East Coast hub for wind industry supply chain. And there are tremendous economic development opportunities that go along with that, with the burgeoning wind industry. And here we have a little bit of a pictorial interlude. What you're looking at here are the two turbines that have recently been installed about 27 miles off the coast of Virginia Beach. Each turbine produces about 6 megawatts of electricity, and this is a test project that will allow Dominion to gather data and help support the building, the build out of the full wind energy area off the coast of Virginia Beach, which is going to be about 2,600 megawatts. Turning now to the regulatory side, we regulate coal mining, mineral mining, and gas and oil drilling in the Commonwealth. On the coal mining side, we've got about approximately 145 licensed sites right now. Not all of them are in active production. We regulate miner safety, reclamation, water quality, and also the abandoned mine program, which is increasingly becoming an economic development opportunity in Southwest Virginia, taking land that was mined before the federal law went into effect in 1977 and putting renewable energy sites on those or turning into ecotourism or various other initiatives being developed on abandoned mine land. We've got about 440 permitted sites for mineral mines, and those are statewide across the Commonwealth, whereas coal and gas are located exclusively in the far Southwest. And those are 440 sites run the gamut from very small sand and gravel pits to large limestone quarries. And we've got about 8,000 natural gas wells. About 80% of those are gas from coal beds, in far Southwest Virginia. So turning now to electricity regulation, Virginia tried to deregulate in the very late 90s, and they found that not to be very successful. So the General Assembly passed what's commonly referred to as re-regulation legislation in 2007, and things were relatively calm until 2015, when in response to the EPA's, at the time, Clean Power Plan, the General Assembly passed legislation to freeze rate reviews by the SEC of the two main investor-owned utilities in the Commonwealth. That lasted for about 3 years until the Grid Transformation Act and Security Act of 2018 was passed. And that established a new review scheme where the SEC would be reviewing rates of the utilities every 3 years. And there are many other things involved with that bill that are beyond the scope of this presentation. And then in 2019, Governor Northam released Executive Order 43. And what that did had three main goals in it, a 30 by 30 goal to have 30% of Virginia's electricity come from renewable sources by 2030, 100% by 2050, and also wanted to achieve those energy goals in a just manner that advances social, energy, and environmental quality. So when the Clean Economy Act was passed, Governor Northam and DMME established a Clean Energy Virginia webinar series. And I'll talk more about that in just a second. But the overarching goals of EO 43 and the Clean Economy Act are, again, to transition Virginia's grid to 100% carbon-free by 2050, a significant build-out of clean energy assets that will drive new investment across the Commonwealth, as the turn to renewable energy does present a tremendous economic development opportunity for clean energy businesses to expand or locate in the Commonwealth. And it also seeks to ensure that energy equity and environmental justice while providing benefits to historically economically disadvantaged communities. We have given Bob a set of slides that we're talking about today, so he can freely distribute those as he wishes to anyone who's interested. And as part of the Clean Energy Virginia webinar series, we encourage you to go to our websites and you can view archived presentations of each webinar where you can really get a deep dive into everything that Al is about to talk about in just a second. And there's also a very useful video that describes the day-to-day operations of Al's shop and all the things we're doing with respect to renewable energy. So before we get to the Clean Economy Act itself, it's important to realize that there also were a number of other important energy legislation items that passed in the 2020 session. First and foremost is probably the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, or REGGI, which is essentially a cap and trade program with the northeastern states that gradually over time caps and limits the number of or tons of emissions that utilities can put into the air, and creating an auction system that generates revenue. And that revenue in Virginia, it was decided by the General Assembly, will go basically half for resilience and climate change and half for energy efficiency for low to moderate income households. The Solar Freedom Bill, that really increased the amount of distributed generation that is allowed in the Commonwealth, rooftop solar, ground mount solar, things of that nature. There are a number of bills dealing with how localities deal with solar projects. That's an issue as more and more land is converted to solar projects. Localities have had some issues dealing with that, and some of this legislation was designed to deal with that very issue. And finally, there was a bill passed that allows the SEC greater determination in how early retirement costs are allocated for coal and gas plants. And that's going to be an issue that's really going to increase in importance in the coming years as there's more renewable energy generation brought online and fossil fuel plants are retired. So I will just hit the big picture items, and then I'll turn it over to Al to dive in deeper into areas of the Clean Economy Act. But one of the biggest changes in the law is that for any new generating facility, be it fossil fuel or renewable based, SEC has to consider the social cost of carbon in any application. So the externalities of pollution have to be considered when the SEC determines whether or not to grant a permit. And they also must ensure that the development of new energy resources or facilities do not have a disproportionate adverse impact on historically economically disadvantaged communities. And that is a term of art that's found in the Clean Economy Act and is defined as communities that are either those in which the majority of the population are people of color or a low-income geographic area. The Clean Economy Act also establishes a percentage of income payment program for low-income households to address energy burden, and the SEC is working on guidelines to set up that program right now as we speak. And it's also important to note that most of the changes that we're going to be talking about here today are applicable to the two primary investor-owned utilities in the Commonwealth, Dominion and Appalachian Power. So at this point, as we really begin to dive into the nitty-gritty of this bill, I'll go ahead and turn it over to Al so he can walk us through that.
All right. Thanks, Mike. I assume we're going to hold questions for the Q&A period at the end. And not hearing otherwise, I will proceed. I ask for everybody to wave or do something if you start to lose the audio. Since I may not know that, Mike's audio broke up for me a few times, but on the whole, I was able to hear him well. And I apologize for the dramatic lighting. I turned off my overhead lights because my follicle challenges only create a great reflection with that overhead light. So the quite a big step for Virginia to establish a mandatory renewable portfolio standard. That was one of the major features in the Clean Economy Act. And as you can see from the slide, there's a slight difference in the schedule where Dominion is supposed to reach a 40% renewable generation portfolio by 2030 and a completely renewable portfolio by the year 2045. Appalachian Power is slightly behind there, and that is primarily in recognition of the smaller growth curve in Appalachian's service territory. A mandatory energy efficiency resource standard is one of the other larger features. Also very significant, and this puts a timeline on energy efficiency improvements to be documented and to reach 5% by 2025 for Dominion and 2% by 2025 for Appalachian, both over a 2019 baseline. And there's another term of art that Mike mentioned. The bill deems a little more than 16,000 megawatts of solar and onshore wind and 5,200 megawatts of offshore wind, plus 2,700 megawatts of energy storage to be in the public interest. And I think many of you have seen this term before, but generally it means that the SCC issues a permit for a project if it has no effect on the reliability of service. It is required by public convenience and necessity, and it is not otherwise contrary to the public interest. And as you have probably read, the General Assembly has made numerous decisions in the public interest in recent years related to the Grid Transformation and Security Act and the Clean Economy Act. The SEC is a regulatory authority, so it is not a rubber stamp. But one of the ways the legislature guides the hand of the regulatory commission is through public policy, such as these public declarations. So a renewable portfolio standard is basically a mandate, and it increases the requirement for the percentage of renewable energy sources for the production of power over a time frame of multiple years. The Commonwealth did have a voluntary standard before that, not nearly as effective as a mandatory standard. And Virginia became, I believe, the 30th, or we are among the 30 states in the district that now have adopted a mandatory RPS. And in Virginia, some specifics of how that will translate into reality, by December 31, 4 years from now, all coal-fired plants in Virginia must close, with the exception of the Virginia City Hybrid Electric Center in Wise County. And by December 31 of 2045, that coal facility, coal and biomass hybrid facility, and all gas-fired plants must close. And here this is a graphical depiction of that incline to reach 100% by 2045 in one case and 2050 in another case. In some states, one of the mechanisms used to help provide financial resources associated with a renewable portfolio standard are renewable energy certificates or credits that can be traded in a free market, and they have value. That is also the case in Virginia, but in Virginia, there is another mechanism that was set up by the Act, which provides for deficiency payment allocations to penalize utilities if they don't meet the goals, the milestones in the standards, the clean energy standards established. And the way that money would be spent, DMME would manage that, and 50% of that would be for job training in historically economically disadvantaged communities. The next largest 30% would be for renewable programs in the same communities. And then the orange piece of the pie, 16%, would be energy efficiency measures for public facilities like government offices, schools. And 4% of that is available for administrative costs. An energy efficiency resource standard, much like the renewable portfolio standard, establishes a long-term mandatory target for the utilities, and they must use energy efficiency measures typically equal to a specific percentage of their load or projected load growth. And Virginia joins the ranks of 27 states with energy efficiency resource standards. Just a quick time check. I think I'm good, Bob. 10 more minutes? maybe 15.
Oh, sure, yeah. You're fine. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So here is the structure or the milestones that the utilities have to meet under the resource standard for energy efficiency. As you can see, next year, Appalachian is 0.5% improvement in efficiency or increase in efficiency compared to the 2019 baseline, and for Dominion, 1.25%, 1.25%. I believe both utilities will easily meet that first year milestone. And then it starts to get a little harder for Appalachian. It goes up to 1%, then to 1.5%, and finally to 2%. Again, in part in recognition that its portfolio of customers is very different from Dominion's. The size of its load is much smaller, and its load growth is much smaller. Primarily because Dominion dominates the data center market in Virginia that is booming and has been booming for a decade. And Dominion must achieve 5% by 2025. Oh, and I'm sorry, I should have mentioned that you can't really set 30-year goals in a vacuum. So the State Corporation Commission will, beginning in 2026, look at the history of the program and establish new annual savings targets for 3-year successive periods at that point. So some of the terms you'll be hearing and or reading in the next slides, DG solar means distributed generation, which is mostly everything that's not utility scale. That's typically behind the meter. Renewable energy certificates, I already mentioned as a one of the revenue sources. It's a market device that wherein entities that are required to meet a renewable energy production standards can trade among themselves to buy and sell those credits in order to meet the standards if they can't do it with investments in generation and renewable energy facilities. Net metering is an approach to customers earning back the basically, you are paid if you have a net metered renewable energy facility. Usually that would be a small rooftop solar system on your house because your meter is switched out for one that will run backward. And at the end of a year, there's a true up. If you have generated more than you've used, you get paid less than full retail. But if you have, for all of the kilowatt hours that you generated, you're basically getting the full retail price for those because you're offsetting your own retail use. And power purchase agreements are key financing mechanism that you'll be reading about in the other slides. Power purchase agreements are very valuable for nonprofit organizations like schools because it is provides a way for them to capture the benefits of federal tax credits. A new solar landscape in Virginia is an understatement. It's almost unrecognizable and will become increasingly more so in the next few years in particular. There is a distributed generation carve-out in the mandatory RPS. Also, we were bumped up against the 1% net metering cap before the act was passed, so it increased it to 6% system-wide. The 1% cap seemed like a big, a high ceiling. For many years it was, and then Virginia rapidly reached it in just a couple of years. I think the 6% cap will look the same. Right now it looks like a lot, and in a few years it probably won't be enough. Third-party PPAs, the capacity for the maximum for the two major utilities increased in Dominion's case from 50 megawatts to 1,000 megawatts. That 50 megawatt cap had been virtually reached, by the way. And the capacity for APCO was raised to 40 megawatts. Standby charges were removed in APCO's territory. There also are a couple of new solar programs. One is called Shared. The other is a multifamily version of Shared Solar. And then some additional homeowner association barriers were removed by the Act. That's been an ongoing process in Virginia to try to strike that balance between what people can do in a mutually agreed to contract and also allow them to capture the benefits of renewable energy to the greatest extent they can within those agreements. And that net metering cap growth is based on the utility's adjusted peak load forecast for the previous year. And you, as you'll see, you can see 1% of that is reserved for low-income customers at least. Also, the size of a system that a residential property can install was increased from 20 kW to 25, which is a pretty substantial system. Typically, people put on, I think the average is something like 5 to 6 kW, and the non-residential size increased from 1 megawatts to 3 megawatts. The maximum size that your system can generate relative to your consumption the previous year was increased to 150% for Dominion, not for APCO. That was necessary because folks who are willing to make the investment in a behind-the-meter system on their property often plan to buy an electric car, or they anticipate other needs that will increase their electric demand. They may be fuel switching to increase the efficiency of their heating system, for example. So this allows you to oversize a system more so than you could in the past. And again, the SEC will revisit this when the utilities get close to those caps. And here's the just a graphical depiction of what I mentioned earlier about Virginia's net metering journey from virtually none to reaching the statewide cap. All happened in a couple of years. And the hockey, I guess this is even more exaggerated than a hockey stick line chart. And you can see that it's really dramatically increased in the last several years. So PPAs are really an essential tool to finance certain systems for particular customers. There's still limits there. It's not as easy as it might be in some states. But for now, it's dramatically improved. The Dominion service territory went from 50 megawatts to 1,000 megawatts cap. 500 megawatts for residential and business, and 500 megawatts for governmental accounts, including schools. In APCO's service territory, it increased to 40 megawatts program capacity and remove some eligibility restrictions. I believe there were some only higher ed and I forgot how the carve-outs worked, but they were somewhat restrictive and those were removed. And Old Dominion Power, which serves a small part of the Southwest Virginia, established its program at 10 megawatts for residential and business, and no cap for governmental customers. And low-income customers are exempt from the minimum facility size limitations. They can install a smaller system. Virginia's energy storage standard is quite ambitious. I believe it is still the largest in the country. I believe it was at the time the act was signed into law. 3,100 megawatts by the end of 2030. Five must be procured or built. Most of that by Dominion. But even the 400 megawatts for Appalachian is quite a large amount. Today, it probably won't look that big when we get near 2025 and 2030. And to make sure that it's not all utility scale, there can be no more than a 500 megawatt single system to count toward the mandate. With one exception, the 800 megawatt pumped hydro storage project that already has been legislated in the public interest for Southwest Virginia is an exception. I'll hurry through a few more slides here. At least 35% of the storage must be procured from third parties. This is to try to stimulate the industry, not to confine it purely to utilities. 10% of the storage should be behind the meter, which would make it customer owned. And those regulations, the regulations to accommodate this energy storage is in a rulemaking process now, due about a year from now. Again, energy equity issues are addressed throughout the act and some of the other legislation and separate legislation focused purely on that. You saw an earlier slide about the percentage of income payment program. DMME is required to report on this, the impacts of on energy burden of the changes created by the act. And to make sure they don't disproportionately affect low-income and other disadvantaged communities. There is increased funding for low-income efficiency programs by the utilities and job training is also directed to help HEDCs when offshore wind force development workforce begins to grow. Right.
Okay. Al and Michael, thank you very much. I've got some questions, but I'm going to be nice and I'm going to actually use the questions first that have come in from our audience. The first one, can you guys read these questions or not? I'll read it because the audience, I think, cannot. We have a question as follows. We're interested in forming a cooperative to finance and implement small solar projects for businesses in Virginia using net metering and PPAs. Do you think such an approach would be feasible under the new legal framework? Our inspiration is Clean Energy Co-op in Northeast Pennsylvania. Did you hear that?
Well, certainly the new legislation is much more friendly to net metering and PPAs than what was enforced or what was in place before the VCEA. You know, obviously the devil is going to be in the details, and we can't really comment on how feasible this would be without Well, we really can't comment on that at all. But the general framework for net metering and PPAs is definitely better, especially in Dominion's service territory, which is, they have about 2/3 of the customers in Virginia. Al, if you want to add to that.
I agree with what you said. The difficulty is in something that other jurisdictions call virtual net metering or aggregated metering. And in Virginia, that's not so easy. There are some exceptions where it is allowed. But again, as Mike said, it would vary by the location, the utility, the size, probably other factors as well, whether that could be done.
Okay. All right. Thanks. You've covered, I think you've answered at least part of this question, but let me read it to you. Will Virginia offer rebates to help citizens of lesser economic resources participate in this effort?
I think the answer to that is not at this time. There is a separate piece of legislation that passed in 2019 that created the Clean Energy Advisory Board. And that is a board that we staff at DMME, and its function is to create a rebate program for low to moderate income households for renewable energy. To date, that program has not yet been funded. And, you know, with the situation we're in with respect to the pandemic, it's uncertain when it will be funded. But that being said, while there are no straight rebate programs in existence, I mean, there has been a tremendous amount of attention on low to moderate income households and how we can better have renewable energy sources reach them. And it's not just in the Clean Economy Act. It's peppered all through some of the other pieces of legislation I talked about in my half of the presentation. So while there's no direct rebates, the utilities and other stakeholders are looking very hard at how to bring renewable energy to low and moderate income households.
Yeah, and that includes, in the case of the utilities, one of those other pieces of legislation created $25 million a year, I believe, for 2 years for renewable energy, $25 million measures low-income households.
Yeah, Al, you were breaking up a little bit there, but he is correct. $25 million for energy efficiency and $25 million for solar over 3 years for, and to be directed at lower to moderate income households.
Let me just add, this is a little related to the last question. I read somewhere, and it's, I know, hard to project, to estimate precisely, but that the Virginia Clean Economy Act will likely raise power rates by something like 24%. Is that crazy, or is that what might happen? What do you think?
Yeah, that's a very contentious issue, and it depends on what assumptions you make with respect to energy efficiency, what assumptions you make with respect to new technologies, what assumptions you make with return with respect to future load growth. It's really hard to say right now. The State Corporation Commission, they did some analysis, and there was some criticism of that analysis because the stakeholders who were doing the criticizing didn't believe the SEC took enough of the benefits of energy efficiency into account. And it just gets really complicated really quickly, and it's really hard to predict with any sort of precision what will happen.
Sure, I understand. Here's a question from Robert Drake. Our HOA requires us to get approval to install solar. Will that change?
There was a separate piece of legislation that passed, apart from the Clean Economy Act, that tried to balance the concerns that Al talked about. And I would encourage the gentleman asking the question to send me an email on this because I don't want to get the numbers wrong. But essentially, it's a balancing test for where if the HOA's restrictions cause the solar cost to either go up by 5% or the productivity to go down of the facility or of the solar panels by 10%, then those restrictions are unreasonable. And I could be off a bit on those numbers. So you've got my email address. Please follow up with me and I'll be happy to make sure I'm giving you the right information.
Okay. Chris Lorish says, this is a great start to addressing climate change. I'm wondering if there are provisions for speeding up the milestones if indicators of climate change, for example, polar ice melting, continue to accelerate. I don't wish to see solar panels covered by seawater along the coast because we didn't move fast enough.
Yeah, that's a...
Can you hear me now? I joined by phone because my audio was so bad.
Yeah, we can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay. In fact, there was amendment to Virginia's energy policy in the code this year that establishes earlier deadlines for reaching economy-wide carbon neutrality. It's sort of a high-level framework for future, for aspirational goals that go beyond what was covered in the Clean Economy Act, for example. I heard part of the question. I didn't hear the part about sea level rise. I'm sorry. Maybe Mike heard that.
The only other thing I would add to that is while there are no specific elements of the VCEA that speed up the milestones, the General Assembly meets every year and they can always come back and make tweaks as they seem necessary.
The thing about sea level rise was the questioner didn't want the sea to be covering the solar panels. Which is good. Please ask more questions if you like. Since I don't see any more right now, I want to ask. I read the act. I didn't. I read the summary of the act, and it is very, very detailed about what Dominion, so forth and so on, how much wind power will be developed, how much storage capacity, so forth and so on. I have read some criticisms while they think this is a great start and all of that, but if you're a kind of a free market person, why not just say, look, we're going to have renewable portfolio standards that get us to 100% renewable energy or non-carbon producing energy by 2050 and let it go at that. Why all the detail?
Well, the legislation's finding various amounts or quantities of renewable generation by source, like offshore wind or land-based wind or battery storage, do allow some leeway there. So there could be more of one than the other. Most of the industry pushback that I've heard about, has been requesting for, interest in maybe modifying legislation next year, next session, or future sessions to make sure that more can be done by entities other than utilities. That's still that may be part of the reason for the sentiment in your question, Bob, is, you know, why pick winners, so to speak.
Yeah.
I don't think the intent was to do that. But then on the other hand, the planning for some projects, offshore wind is a great example. it's such a long time frame that I think the utility has been making the case and trying to make the case and will continue to push that they need some kind of certainty. If we're going to do offshore wind, we have to know that it's going to be acceptable to the SEC. So I won't try to answer it for every carve out that's in there. But some of the carve outs, it should be noted, are not mandates, or they are soft mandates because there are no penalties, like battery storage, for example. It reads like a mandate, but it doesn't have efficiency payments attached to it like the renewable portfolio standard does.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks.
I think the only thing I would add to that is having specific procurement targets for specific types of resources also sends economic development signals to developers that Virginia is open for business for solar and wind and storage. So that also explains, I think, why it went into such detail.
I see. Yeah, thank you. Let me, I have a question, two questions from Rich DeMong. You started off showing us those wind turbines, and he wants to know, just estimate, please, just how many houses would those things we saw in the beginning of the talk power, just to put it in practical terms?
Those two, I believe Dominion has said they would power 12,000 houses. The larger commercial development, which is also underway, the pre-construction parts of that have been underway for more than a year. And Dominion has committed to beginning the first phase of three phases for the 2,600 megawatt commercial wind farm by 2024, and to finish the 2,600 megawatts by 2026. That amount of energy would power, I believe it's 650,000 home equivalent. So basically all of Hampton Roads.
Let me move. We have lots of questions and not so much time. Rich also says, you mentioned cooperation with Northeastern states. Do you see the possibility of cooperation with other states in the region?
We already are cooperating, and the most recent example is, again, on offshore wind. Virginia, Maryland, and North Carolina just signed a memorandum of understanding whereby the three states agree to work regionally to develop the offshore wind industry supply chain, which we believe, and those two other states do, that that will make all of us more attractive to large-scale development and investment in the supply chain. And those are very substantial investments. And Virginia obviously has benefited already and would like to continue to be a first mover as that supply chain develops. That's one example. Reggie is confined to the states that belong to it, and Virginia was the first southern state, or the southernmost state, to join Reggie. But you can see signs of this is changing. I think that there will be other states in the Mid-Atlantic and south of Virginia that will be engaged in the same kind of climate and energy legislation that Virginia has been so involved in, especially in the last 3 years.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Is Virginia expecting any help from the federal government? I guess on costs. I don't know.
I don't know. I've always heard you don't want to let anybody in the door who says, I'm from the government, I'm here to help. Is that true? well, we are receiving a huge, not just Virginia, but from my perspective in the State Energy Office, we've been in a partnership with the U.S. Department of Energy and the U.S. EPA, the U.S. Department of Transportation, U.S. Homeland Security, many, many other federal agencies provide resources. Sometimes that's money in the form of grants. Sometimes it's technical assistance. Many of the federal labs, for example, we work hand in hand with them. Changes by administration. Under this administration at the federal level, there's probably been less apparent cooperation and support especially for climate-related action. But the federal agencies are carrying on as they have in the past. And ironically, when the federal budget from the White House is cut, it's not only is the money usually restored, it's usually increased by the time the budget is finally passed. That's been the experience, at least with renewable energy and energy efficiency programs at the federal level that we participate in and benefit from.
All right. The only thing I'd add is that, as talks pick back up on a potential second round of some form of stimulus, it's possible that there could be, I've seen some readings out there that there could be possible that there could be an increase in the tax credits, federal tax credits that are available for solar that are currently scaled to be scaled down in future years. And there could also be an energy storage tax credit work into there. But obviously, we're a long way from anything being a done deal on that front, but it's possible.
Thanks. All right. Another quick question. Do the offshore wind turbines present a navigation hazard?
Well, they would, except that's being addressed as part of the planning and operation of the turbines. There's been a large task force in place for a decade now that now covers Virginia and North Carolina, and it includes the Coast Guard and the military. The military obviously has a lot to say about what goes out there. They're very busy. We have the largest naval base in the world. We have lots of military aircraft, submarines. So we have the Space Flight Center. And all of those users, as well as, have to be accommodated. There was a process used to set the boundaries for the wind energy lease that took years. And there was a series of public hearings and public comment periods. And their work will have to continue forever in that regard. There are some commercial fisheries that are concerned. We are fortunate in the sense that this is not Martha's Vineyard or someplace like off the coast of Massachusetts where there is a huge commercial fishing industry. It's a smaller industry, but nonetheless important. And so that's being taken into consideration in the planning and spacing of the turbines. And so far, there has been acceptance, and the biggest player there is the U.S. military, and they have signed off on where the terminals are being built now. But they will continue to review and look at the details as development actually occurs, because what's on paper is all they could look at years ago. Now the turbines are actually being constructed. And the sizes of the turbines have increased and will continue to increase. The ones that are out there now are 6-megawatt machines. Dominion has already said they're they'll probably use 12 megawatt machines, turbines in the commercial development. So those details may change the spacing and other considerations, but it will continue to be necessary. And Virginia has done, I think, quite a good job in partnership with the U.S. Department of Interior, which owns the sea bottom, to make sure that all of those ocean users, including the wildlife that lives there, are treated fairly.
Okay. All right. We're running out of time. I don't see any other questions from the audience. I want to ask you a closing question, maybe. The University of Virginia here in Charlottesville has the Energy Transition Initiative at the Weldon Cooper Center for Public Service. You folks at DMME are one of the supporters of that, I think. At the Clean Energy Summit meeting in October, the director of the Energy Transition Initiative, Professor Bill Shoba, laid out an analysis of what it would take for Virginia to get to net zero carbon emissions by 2050. Now, just I want to remind the audience, the power sector is only about 30% of our carbon emissions or so. So there's an awful lot of carbon that isn't being addressed in the Clean Economy Act. Just off the cuff, what do you guys think about the possibility of trying to move more aggressive and that more aggressive front?
I think you will definitely see movement, especially in the transportation sector, which is the largest area of emissions. Virginia is speaking with some other states about potentially, assuming there's legislative approval, doing something similar to RGGI, but for transportation. And I think you will also see movements in the building electrification sector, because that's another big chunk of the pie when it comes to carbon emissions, is our buildings.
Yeah. So you're reasonably optimistic about that.
I'm very optimistic that steps will be taken to try to address those things.
Good. Al, are you going to weigh in?
No, I can't really add much to that. You know, Mike is more familiar with the prior sessions than am I. But there have been bills introduced for years to tackle those other sectors in addition to the electric generation sector, and they've been dusted off. They're ready to come forward again, and we'll see. The next session starts before you know it. But I will be. In fact, Mike and I have a private bet on the speed at which those other two thirds of the pie, when it comes to carbon emissions in the Virginia economy, right, buildings and transportation, when we are involved in programs to reduce emissions in those sectors as well as the power sector.
But what's the private bet?
It's a bottle of scotch, and I'm going to win.
All right. Wait. One last question here, and then this is going to have to be it. It's from Peyton Williams. Too bad we can't get an anti-idling ordinance. 10 seconds of idling is the amount of gas it takes to turn motor on and off. All right. Comments to that, or do you agree?
Well, one thing I can say is that there's also going to be a push towards more electric vehicle growth in the Commonwealth, and that's, we've already seen that happening with the Volkswagen settlement and some infrastructure that's going in that our friends at DEQ are managing, and that's an area that's going to grow considerably as well.
Okay. All right. Gentlemen, thank you very much for this interesting and important presentation. We really appreciate your taking the time to be with us on this Zoom meeting. So I speak for everybody and senior statesmen of Virginia and anybody else who's listening. Thank you a lot. We'll be looking at the Virginia Clean Economy Act as it goes forward. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.